You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. I'm Rebecca Winthrop, the director of the Center for Universal Education here at Brookings. And again, thank you so much to everyone for coming out today. I'm really pleased. We have a great panel of people, and I won't go through their bios in depth because you will have them in your packets, but a really warm welcome to Yolande Miller-Granvaux, who's a senior education advisor at USAID, and to Lori Henninger, who's the director of the Interagency Network for Education and Emergencies, as well as Susie Nodhurste, who's the head of international development at CFPT Education Trust. And unfortunately, it's not on the program, but we were hoping to have a colleague, Barbara McDonald Moore, who is the director of international programs at the Canadian Teachers Federation. But unfortunately, she hurt her back, poor thing. So we send her warm thoughts. I'll tell her that the whole room was sending her warm thoughts. I'm sure you will appreciate that. But she has a lot of experience working with teacher organizations in low-income countries and would have lent a great perspective. So we'll try to channel her voice as best we can. So today, the topic of our conversation is around teachers, and particularly teachers who are working in some of the hardest places around the world, specifically fragile states and states affected by armed conflict. And there's a number of reasons why this is an important topic. One of them is, of course, if you take a child rights perspective and you care about child rights, which I hope you all do, although it's not always the strongest argument, I have to say, when you are talking to senior policymakers. But, of course, there's a large number of kids out of school who live in fragile states around the world. So it's about 42% of all the kids out of school around the world live in these contexts. So it's a big chunk of kids who need access to quality education. And, of course, if you care about meeting the Millennium Development Goals, you need to focus on these contexts. There's also, if the child rights argument doesn't do it for you, there's also a much more hardcore state-building argument to make about why you need to pay attention to teachers in these contexts. Education is often, if you do it right, and do it equitably, and we'll be talking a lot about what it means to do it right now, is an early peace dividend for building state capacity and building resilient communities in the wake of armed conflict in particular. Making sure there's a lot of recent research that shows service delivery, in particular of education, because education is so pervasive. There's a school in every, you know, little community across a country, is a really powerful symbol of states re-engaging and providing support to their citizens. And so, of course, for either of those perspectives, you need teachers. Teachers are the absolute key ingredient for getting education systems up and running in these contexts, and for sustaining education amid conflict as well. And just a couple of reasons around really why teachers are so essential. In these contexts, teachers are on the front lines. And when we talk about being on the front lines, it often is teachers, not hardly any perhaps school administrators or principals, but teachers in very difficult conditions who are sustaining education during crisis contexts, and who are really the ones from the ground up rebuilding education systems, in particularly in contexts of recovery or post-conflict. Another reason, of course, is that teachers are a huge percentage of any country's civil servant cohort, often even more than military. So they are a big bonus for many governments. There's a lot of teachers to on any government payroll, and governments need to really think about how to take care of them and how to support them to do the job they need to do. And along with that is the issue of budget. Teacher salaries is usually the biggest chunk of any education budget. So it behooves us to get it right, to get sort of this question of teacher support, particularly on salaries, to get it right, because it is often the salary system supporting teachers with regular pay that seems like such a basic fundamental thing you would need for any education system, but is one of the biggest bottlenecks to restarting education services during crisis and after crisis. And so that is what motivated us, and I say us because I hope you all have gotten a copy of this report that we've done together here at Brookings with CFPT Education Trust. And it's authored by four of us, Janice Dolan, April Golden, Susie, who I already introduced, and myself. And we really felt like what we wanted to explore was do this better, meaning pay teachers in the context better, particularly when there perhaps is no banking system, there is no lists of, you know, teachers who are teaching, there is no reliable monitoring or audit system. You know, it's a very difficult context. So what are the creative ways out there that people are being able to use to grapple with this issue? So with that, I think I will stop. And what we'll do is I'll turn it over to my colleague Susie, who will give an overview of the report and our main findings, and then invite the panelists up and we'll have a discussion with all of you. Susie?
Thank you, Rebecca. So as Rebecca has just said, this report really is the outcome of a research partnership between the Centre for Universal Education here at Brookings and CFPT Education Trust. We've been grappling with these issues over the last couple of years, and this report, and we've also got some electronic published case studies, is the sort of culmination of this research programme. And really, just to give you a bit of background for this research, we came up with this framework that you'll be able to see up here. We were trying to grapple with the issue of teacher salary systems and what components made up an effective teacher salary system so that we could understand where some of the problems lie and then actually look at where we could look at some potential solutions. So based on very broadly on sort of public financial management processes, systems, and principles, and how that particularly relates to paying salaries, we came up with this framework. And it's very much built around a sort of input process output kind of model, with the idea that you've got financial resources going into the system, which act as levers for the system. You've got a series of cogs that make up the system, and the key idea here was that these were cogs that were very much interrelated, that moved together so that as the resources flow through the system, flow through these processes, the output could be that teachers actually receive their salaries. And we saw this very much as a dynamic system. And we broke the system down into the sort of the set of blue cogs you see, which are financial management cogs of the system, so the banking system, the public financial management systems, and the audit system. And then more, the pink cogs you see, which are more around information management, so issues around the payroll and issues around EMIS and TMS, which are the education management information system and the teacher management system. We very much saw these cogs as being interrelated, that actually if you had blockage in one cog, it didn't just mean that the rest of the cogs flow freely and that cog didn't matter too much, but actually it had a really negative knock-on impact on some of the other cogs. So just to draw on one example, if you've got a system where you really don't know who's in your teaching force, who's teaching in a particular school, what qualifications they have, what salary level they have, and when they started in that school, if you don't have information on that, it's very difficult to have an accurate payroll. And what you'll find is that you've got some basic system you're using to teach to pay teachers, but as one teacher moves to another school and gets a promotion, their information may not be updated. So either they receive two salaries, or they only receive the salary from the old school. If someone actually retires or leaves the teaching profession, they may continue to be paid for many months because records haven't been updated. So there are clear linkages between some of the different cogs here, and a weakness or a blockage in one cog very much has a knock-on negative impact on some of the other cogs. So looking at how we went about the research, we did a global literature review, and we also undertook some in-depth desk-based country case studies around Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sierra Leone to look at how the teacher salary systems worked or didn't work in those contexts and what lessons could be learnt. We also drew on examples from other countries from the wider literature. And as we drew on this literature, we identified 17 key challenges that we felt, I mean, there are probably some other little ones as well, but we felt 17 was a pretty big number to deal with to start with, but we identified 17 major challenges. And these challenges correspond, so there are several around the financial resources and levers, and then there are several around each of the five cogs. And our idea was to try and identify what some of these challenges were so that we could look for potential solutions. And in looking at solutions, we tried to look at both tried and tested solutions that had been piloted or used in some way in one or more countries, as well as some potential solutions that were really ideas or very early piloting stage that actually need some further research on how they could potentially work. And we categorized our solutions into three groups. One set of solutions is around incremental change, just making small changes to the existing system to make it better. The second group was around step change, which was making a more fundamental change to the existing system to make it more efficient. And the third set of solutions was really around bypassing the existing system, admitting that the system was so broken that to try and just incrementally change it wasn't really going to achieve anything. So at least for the short to medium term, the best solution was to actually come up with something totally different, which might just be a temporary measure while the existing system is actually created or built, or it might actually be by bypassing the system, you create a totally new system that works better. So I'm just going to outline briefly just four of the solutions we came up with. There are quite a few more that you'll be able to see if you read the report, but I'm just focusing in on four today. And the first two solutions I'm looking at are different solutions that address challenges in the banking system. Both of these solutions bypass the system, and I think one of them really has the potential to create a new system that might be more sustainable. So the first solution was around contracting out salary payments. Where the banking system is weak or it's collapsed, and it's just not actually, you're not able to get salaries from the Central Ministry of Finance through the banking system to pay teachers, one of the things we found that evidence for was actually contracting out the payment of salaries to a third party. So we found from Sierra Leone that they had a system where the Ministry of Education was in charge of teacher salaries and ensuring that teachers got paid through the Ministry of Finance and the banking system. And actually the system they had resulted in a 42% loss. So only 42% of budgeted salary amounts were actually arriving in teachers' bank accounts or in teachers' hands. And the Ministry of Education said, well, let's try something different. So they subcontracted an international accountancy firm and said, well, could you do this for us? And the firm charged a 10% management fee, but actually managed to reduce loss from 42% to 8.5%. So really significant efficiency saving that more than covers the service fee they charged. So that's just one example of contracting out. A second example that we drew from Afghanistan was the potential of mobile banking. Afghanistan as a country has banks, and only 7% of the population have access to banks, which is a pretty small proportion of a very large population. Yet by contrast, around 40% of the population have mobile phones, and actually mobile phone penetration or coverage is extended to about three quarters of the country. And a system that's been piloted with the security sector in paying the police force has been using mobile banking. So you've got a mobile phone, and at the end of the month, your salary is kind of paid by text to your mobile phone. You can then go into certain identified shops locally and show this text, and in exchange, you're either giving credit against goods in the shop or cash payments. It's an innovative form of mobile banking that's been used quite a lot in other countries. In Kenya, the M-Pesa scheme was a start of this, and they've tried to adapt that in Afghanistan in this pilot for the security forces. And this has real potential to be applied to for teachers. Hasn't been done so yet. But I think what's really unique about this potential solution is the challenges that we have in scaling up innovative approaches in fragile states is so enormous to look at how do you scale up a small intervention. And if you think only 7% of the population have access to banks, to try and build, even in the next 2 to 3 years, a national banking system is an incredible investment. It's an enormous investment, just building the infrastructure, let alone having the personnel that are trained in the systems and so on. But actually, if 70% of the population 70% of the population is within mobile networks, the potential of actually building up and scaling up a system of paying people through mobile banking is much more credible and possible over a 2 to 3 year period with investment than actually building a national banking system. So this has the potential to create a sort of whole new system that works more effectively. A third solution is one around involving civil society in the broader budget process. This specifically addresses weaknesses in the audit and public financial management COGS. And this is not a new process. Civil society have been engaged in budget work in a number of different fragile states for a number of years, particularly in places like Nigeria, Sri Lanka, Pakistan. And one of the most sort of well-known examples of how civil society's involvement in public information campaigns can result in sort of stronger and more accountable financial systems comes from Uganda sort of about a decade ago. And this example is around the use of capitation grants, where the Central Ministry of Education was paying per capita grants for non-salary expenditures to schools. But actually 80% of this money was disappearing on the route from the Ministry of Education to schools. And as a result of a widespread public information campaign of just posting at each school a simple notice that said, allocation from the Central Ministry of Education X, amount actually received by school Y, that significantly increased the money that was arriving at schools, and wastage and leakage dropped from 80% to a mere 20% over a six-year period. Now, this was specifically for non-salary expenditure, but exactly the same process could be used and applied to look at teacher salaries and whether teacher salaries are actually arriving at their intended destination. And then the last solution I'm just going to look at today is around the information management area, addressing weaknesses in payroll verification and information management, and the importance of linking those two systems to have more effective information. And one of the examples we've got here is drawn from Southern Sudan prior to independence back in 2008, where a headcount index was undertaken just to see, well, who are our teachers, what are their qualifications, where are they working, what grade are they on, and so on. And this information was gathered and then linked electronically to the payroll and to the education management information system so that all that information could be triangulated and kept in one place. And the result of this, which doesn't necessarily sound very significant, but was very significant at that point in time, was that the government for the first time had the information with which to actually work out how to equitably resource each of the states with the right sort of amount of money to pay their teachers with. Because in the past, it had just been, oh, well, here's your allocation, state X, here's your allocation, state Y, without really knowing, well, how many teachers of what qualification were in each state. So it resulted in slightly more equitable resource allocation. And a second example, again on linking EMIS with payroll, comes from Sierra Leone, where they took a slightly different approach, which is a bit more of a step change approach. And as they gathered information on teachers, they decided to go a little bit step further than just gathering names and basic information. They took some biometric information. They also took a photo of every teacher. And they used that identity to just check with other teachers and triangulate their information to see, well, actually, is this person really teaching, or are they a ghost teacher, a teacher who is drawing a salary but actually not involved in teaching at all? And this was very much to address problems of ghost teachers on the payroll and helped increase accountability. So those are just sort of four solutions that I've highlighted. There are many others within the report that you might want to look at. But just to conclude, as Rebecca's already highlighted, teachers are the most visible part of an education system. Often we think that actually a school building's really important, textbooks and other learning products are really important. And yes, whilst in one sense lots of inputs have some importance, what you'll find in many of these contexts is a classroom that's been bombed and shelled, and you've got a few walls standing, the blackboard's been destroyed, there are no chairs, no tables, no books. And yet a teacher might be under a tree teaching a whole group of children, regardless of the fact that the classroom's not there, regardless of the fact there's no textbook, there's no chalk. Somehow a teacher has decided to take the responsibility of teaching those children with very little resources. I think teachers are the critical part of an education system. They are the people who inspire learning and enable learning to take place. And as Rebecca's also outlined, teacher salaries can take up the supermajority of an education budget. Often it's up to 90% of an education budget in some contexts being spent on teacher salaries. So if we don't spend that bit right, then actually anything we spend on anything else is going to be pretty ineffective. I think one of the main messages of our report is that whilst there's been a big advocacy campaign over the last decade for more money for education in fragile and conflict-affected estates, something that we'd wholeheartedly agree with, one of our main messages is that more money is not enough. What we really need is early intervention and investment to build a teacher salary system. Otherwise, actually, just having more money is like having water and pouring it into a system of broken pipes. It just leaks. It never gets to the tap, or very little actually gets to the tap to give people clean drinking water. We've got a similar thing going on in education. If we just pour more money into these countries without actually trying to build sustainable institutions and systems, then it's going to be just pouring money in that has very little effect or very little impact. And just to close with a few recommendations, I think one of the overarching things that our report came out with is the importance of context. And whilst the solutions that we found we don't feel are just specific to one particular country and couldn't be applied elsewhere, there's a lot of cross-application. But I think what we felt was that actually each country is unique and they have different blockages in different parts of their salary systems. And therefore, an intervention which, like it for Afghanistan, that was really important around the banking system, may not be appropriate for a different country whose banking system is okay, but whose information system is really, really weak. So it's important to understand the context of each country and look at solutions that will specifically address the blockages that are a problem in that country's system. And this very much reflects the OECD DAC principles for good international engagement in fragile states and situations, which talk about taking context as a starting point, making sure that you contextualize any solutions. But just to highlight a few of the sort of key recommendations, again, we've outlined more detailed recommendations in the report, particularly recommendations to national governments and to donors separately. But just to highlight a few, I think one of the key ones is to make sure that we're considering the use of alternative payment channels to pay teachers in the short term, especially when the current system is broken to the extent where actually things aren't functioning well and teachers are not getting paid. Another recommendation is the importance of investing in different blocks of the teacher salary system. Again, looking at context, ensuring that we are investing in the blocks that are most broken. And related to that, there are certain interventions we can do that actually impact upon multiple cogs in the system rather than just one. And I think it's critical that we can, where we can, try and look at how we can support such interventions, because they're likely to have much more impact than just supporting an intervention that just looks at one cog. And I think a really important message for donors, particularly education sector donors, is where it's very easy to look in silos and think where the education sector, we must support things that are very specifically educational and within the education sector. And I think a key message coming out of our report is that the education sector is part of a national system in a country. And yes, education sector interventions are important, but actually if we're going to support teacher salary systems, support needs to be given to actually building wider institutions in a country around the banking sector, the audit function, and the National Audit Office, and even the National Revenue Authority. And actually supporting those very institutions is going to help have a knock-on impact, positive impact on how the education system functions. And so we shouldn't just look purely narrowly at the education sector, but we should look at it and how it interacts with other wider national institutions. So I think just to conclude, our overarching message really is the need to support teacher salary systems rather than just pay salaries. And we need to do this by removing the blockages that exist in different countries that prevent the cogs within the systems from turning. If we don't do this, I'll just go back to the analogy I mentioned a few minutes ago, it'll be like pouring water into a system of broken pipes. We don't just want to pour millions and millions of dollars, whether it's of national taxpayers' money or of US citizens' taxpayers' money or British citizens' taxpayers' money, into a system that is really broken, where our money is just going down a black hole. Thank you.
Thank you, Susie, for this terrific presentation. I've personally been looking forward to this presentation. This is a study I have wanted to see take place for years, and it pushes the reset button. And I think you demonstrated it very well. It's not only just the water, but it's really the water in the tap, but it's really pushing the reset button. In fragile states, what I've seen over the years is we rush in to do teacher training. We rush in to do management information systems for kids. And we do that over and over and over again. And then 4 or 5 years later, we do an evaluation that says, well, quality is still very low, and the students still are not performing well, and the teachers really don't show up, and really the teachers really can't read, and they cannot write, and actually they just don't show up, and then we stop there, and we do more teacher training and more management information system. But no one asks the questions, who are these teachers? Where do they come from? Where are they going to go? Are they going to grow, or not? And then they're not paid. We all know that. But what is the system that needs to be put in place to support the institutional foundation of the teacher development system? So we're really pushing the reset button. Two things that I just want to say. One is, without strengthening a teacher management system based on a sound financial system, we will not get to our access goals. We will not reach our quality goals. We will not reach our relevance goals. That is very clear. So each time we look at these outcomes that we are aiming to attain, we have to step back and look at these different cogs and these different levers, and see each time we design a program, which lever can we effectively support or give focus to. One more thing I want to add. When I was in Burundi, I found out that there were two teacher salary systems. And that was a while ago. And it blew me away. There were two of them. One was for the Hutus, one was for the Tutsis. And of course, you couldn't see it, right? I mean, you really had to probe to find out. And if we had had the vision to look at the system that Susie, focused on for, in this presentation, we would have probably seen the extent to which a system can make things worse and can eventually force teachers to play a role in a genocide that, you know, they should not have played. So that just my initial reactions, and thank you again, Susie. Rebecca asked me to take this opportunity to talk a little about USAID, so I'll just put up my USAID hat on for a little bit. I'm in the Office of Education at USAID. And, you know, we have an education strategy that has a goal, goal three, which aims at supporting education in conflict and crisis-affected environments. And raising access to learners in these environments. And one thing we have discussed recently, and we're still discussing it, is how to be strategic. We cannot focus on everything. We don't have unlimited resources. So what can we focus on these in these fragile states? And we are discussing a strategic framework that looks at four main directions. We're discussing it. We are discussing it at this point. the first direction is to look at the equity of access. It is looking at alternative delivery channels for access. So we are looking at equity in terms of not just urban, rural, or girls, boys, but really in terms of identity lines, geographic lines, and that type of equity. We're also looking at alternative delivery systems that include accelerated learning programs. We're looking at low-cost private schools, affordable private schools, and we're looking at the non-formal education services that I'm sure you know very well. The second axis we're focusing on is strengthening and stabilizing an education system. And of course we could do everything, but we cannot. So what we're focusing on is, guess what? What Susie, and has nothing to do, the CFBT study really has nothing to do with our decision, but it's really supporting what we believe we should be doing. And it is strengthening the teacher management information system. The presentation here calls it the teacher development information system.
Teacher management system.
Teacher management system. We're calling the teacher management information system, same thing. But it is looking at stabilizing a system by stabilizing the payment, the compensation of teachers, including the teachers who are teaching in this alternative education delivery services. We're also looking at, of course, the capacity of the management information systems to link to the teacher management information system. The third direction we're looking at is issues of safety of access in terms of violence mitigation and safety as guaranteed by the community to ensure that not only students are safe when they walk to school, but teachers, especially women, can also go to a school. I just got back from Kabul, and when we look at the community-based education program and we come up with teacher training programs in a clustered, through a clustered approach where we ask teachers to walk 3 kilometers to go to a training in a clustered school, none of the women can make it. None of the female teachers can go. They cannot go 3 kilometers. They can go 1 kilometer. So, we need to look at issues of safety and cultural boundaries. And finally, the fourth focus for USAID is to look at security in the schools, looking at same thing, security of access, but also the right messaging, whether the curriculum, whether the teaching practices are addressing issues of tolerance, violence, and so on and so forth. And all of this, of course, is to reach also quality outcomes. I mean, if we promote equitable access, it has to be equitable access for what? Well, for quality education, obviously. We also look at post-primary We know that the most impact we can have on the stabilization of a country is to focus on the post-primary cycle of education. So these are the different areas that we have been focusing on. Now I will just ask my colleagues to provide initial reactions to the presentation, and I will ask Lori first. Quick first reaction to the presentation. Lori.
Thank you, Yolande. Hello, everybody. I have some points about the study that I just sort of like to go through. First of all, I think that the report itself, the study itself, is a really good build. I think the report is very well done, first of all. And I think it's a great building block if we're looking at achieving quality education. Because if teachers, being a former teacher many years ago, if teachers are not paid, there's not a lot of incentive to go to work every day. And I think that what happens in the classroom between the students and the teacher is really sort of the fundamental starting point for quality education. I think Susie's absolutely right when she talks about whether it's in a classroom or under a tree. That relationship and that learning is absolutely critical. So, getting paid leads to retention, it leads to motivation, and I think most importantly, it leads to hope. And I think, I hear Gordon Brown say this all the time, that hope is really the key in terms of thinking about the future and one of the things that education provides. I think the report is a really helpful step-by-step guide on how financing mechanisms can operate and information systems and how they link. I think it can be very helpful for donors and NGOs when working with not only ministries of education, but also ministries of finance in a country. I think it can be very helpful for the cluster system when they're working with ministries of education in particular. I think also that there's a very clear distinction in this report between the resources that run the system and the system itself. And I think that's a distinction that's not often made and has been lifted up and is very, very important. And one of the reasons it's so important in my thinking is that it allows you to be able to pinpoint where the problems are. Instead of lumping it all together, it allows you to sort of tease it out in your thinking and to have the opportunity to say, okay, in this cog, we have this problem, but we also have the resource problem. So how do those things work together? I'm also glad to see that context is taken so much into account throughout the report. I think, one of the things that in INEE we stress all the time with our tools and any of the work that we do is that you have to start where people are. You have to start with the context. And if you don't start with the context, then you're developing a one-size-fits-all approach, and that's just not good for anybody. I also think that pointing out the use of IT in terms of possibly paying teachers via phone or other systems like that is an inventive and really helpful approach. And I think about it for a lot of reasons. One is, as Susie talked about, the reconstruction of a finance system within a country can be a years-long project. And it's not just the reconstruction of a finance system, but if you go to Liberia or to any country where there's flooding and there's very rural schools, getting to the schools to be able to pay the teachers is impossible at some points during the year. If you're talking about Afghanistan up in the mountains, it may be impossible to get there. Building infrastructure in a country is a decades-long and hugely expensive proposition. So we're not just talking about a finance system, but we're talking about an entire infrastructure system. So thinking about creative ways as were brought up in this report, I think is very was very helpful. I was very glad to see the link between the government and the community and sort of a bi-directional conversation within the report, and looking at civil society as a vehicle of tracking and promoting transparency. Fantastic. I think there's a couple of dilemmas within the paper. One is that the issue of political will and funding and construction of systems is sort of implied, but is never really lifted up. And if you look at the situation in Sudan, the government of Sudan really did not want to finance schools in Darfur. You know, there was a very clear policy there, or a very clear, maybe hidden policy, but very clear. And I think that there's a whole issue of political will that needs to be examined more thoroughly. The issue of breaking of funding, particularly between humanitarian and development and humanitarian, and within humanitarian funding itself, having to reapply every 6 months, that was left until the end, in terms of donor funding. I think it's one of the most difficult issues. Mm-hmm. Difficult issues in conflict-affected and fragile states, given that the average length of conflict in the least developed states is 12 years. So if we're talking about interrupted funding cycles, the resources being put in directly impact how those cogs are able to function or not able to function. As much as I agree with the leaky pipe metaphor, and I think that's a great one, and I think this report really helps to answer some of those leaky pipe questions, only 0.9% of humanitarian funding goes to education. And so, I'm not talking about development funding here, I'm talking about humanitarian funding in 2012. There's not enough resources going in by any stretch of anybody's imagination to even think that a system like this, looking at the system, could work. And I think that one of the things that the report would be more helpful is if there was specific lifting up of the issues and dilemmas surrounding refugee and IDP populations, because I think that a lot of these things are very applicable to teachers in those situations. But I also think that there are national government issues, host country government issues that can somewhat be addressed by what's in the report, but also need some special treatment on their own. But altogether, I think this report really fills a gap and is much needed. So thank you.
Thank you, Lori. That's a rich reaction. Rebecca?
Yeah, and thanks to both of you, actually, to both you, Yolanda and Lori, for your inputs. And I'm very happy to hear that USAID is going to be tackling teacher compensation, or in theory. Well, South Sudan, you are already.
That's right,
yeah.
South Sudan.
Yeah,
we are.
And looking forward to hopefully more. So, I mean, I think for us, part of what motivated Susie and I when we sort of discussed even doing this report, and this gets a little bit to your political will question, Lori, which those were all very useful comments, is, when we talked about, well, what piece of research could we do on this issue that could be helpful, we felt like over the last 6-7 years, the issue writ large of education in fragile states or fragile conflict-affected states had really gotten a lot more attention. So it's on the agenda. Recently now it's a 1/3 of USAID's education policies. And so it's on people's minds. And it's less about sort of, is this a burning issue to focus on, and more about, well, how do you deal with it? I think that's what we have to all collectively grapple with now. Okay, now people know that this is a problem. What are we supposed to do concretely, the how stuff? So I agree, actually, we did totally sidestep the issue of political will, and it's true. The other thing we sidestepped, just you didn't name it, but I'll put it out there,
was the issue of how much you should pay teachers. And that is a very big issue, and it's an entire, you know, research project unto itself, because there's lots of questions of sequencing and levels and how much money you have now, and then if you peg it too high or too low, or different parts of the country, are they paid different levels, and then how can you sustain that over time to build a real education system post-conflict? It's very complicated stuff, and it gets to Lori's very good point about the fact that refugee education systems often have different ways of paying teachers. You often going through the UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee body, and it's a totally different scale set, a set of teacher payment. And so it's very thorny, that issue, and we didn't touch that at all. So I guess ultimately both Susie and I felt like what we really want, if nothing else, we want this report to be useful both for governments, but in truth, we had donors a lot in mind. We had all the donor agency, whether it's the Global Partnership for Education or USAID or the British or even foundations, but some of the bigger, the World Bank in particular, you know, some of these bigger donors who actually can provide a very large percentage at the end of the day of the total budget of some of these countries, that they should not close their eyes to the issue of teacher salaries. Because for many years, donors have said, we don't pay recurrent costs, we don't pay teacher salaries. Because, gosh, once we start paying them, my God, when will we ever stop? We'll never be able to get out. So one can sympathize. I can sympathize. But I think that is beginning to change a little bit. I mean, certainly we see USAID starting to do it. You know, GPE is doing it, et cetera, in certain contexts. So for us, the issue is, you know, just tackle the issue straight on. Tackle the issue of teacher compensation and paying teachers. And, you know, don't sort of let it sit and wait for, oh, well, once the Ministry of Finance gets its act together, because it could be years. You know, some of this motivation for me at least comes from spending time in the field working with teachers and children in schools in these contexts. And I was always so surprised how, in Afghanistan in particular, right after, in around 2003 or right after the ousting of the Taliban, the international donors came together really quickly and they established a pooled fund and they started paying police and security personnel. So they can do it. Like, it's feasible, it's possible. Why couldn't you do the same thing for teachers? I mean, that would be a great sort of way to get a rapid peace dividend, in my mind. So, anyways, I think I'll stop there. I know maybe we have a few more minutes for comments, but I'm sure
others will want to. Yeah, we'll heard the appeal, Rebecca. Thank you. So I'm going to ask a question to each of the panelists, then we'll open it up to a question and answer session. And my first question is for Susie, and I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this research differs from other research endeavors that have been undertaken in this fragile states.
I think in a couple of ways. I think this piece, as Rebecca's already alluded to, we wanted to get beyond just looking at one specific issue in an issues-based context. And we also wanted to build on the really good work that's already in the INE guidance notes on teacher compensation, which address issues of specifics around compensation and what you should look at when you're trying to establish how to pay teachers in these contexts. And we felt like a lot of research had been done on the side of aid flows to for education in these contexts. So there was a really good evidence base now that showed that actually education in fragile and conflict-affected contexts was much more poorly funded, both humanitarian and development. I mean, humanitarian to an extreme extent, as you've just outlined, Laurie. But even the development funding, if you can compare the amounts that are going for education in fragile and conflict-affected situations compared to that going to other low-income countries, there's a huge mismatch according to need. And we felt that that had been adequately researched and the message was out there and people were slowly beginning to take that on board. We wanted to sort of go the next step on and say, well, okay, well, if we're putting more money in and if actually more money starts to flow, what should that flow for? What should be the main components? And we just felt that the teacher salary piece was such an important component because of this large proportion of the budget it takes up. So that was one aspect. And I think the other aspect, we were really wanting to look at a systems approach and look beyond just a narrow part of the education sector and actually look at components which really impacted upon the education sector, but actually which were largely external to the sector. So issues such as the banking sector, you wouldn't immediately think about support to the banking sector as having any impact at all on education, yet it's a key factor in how teachers are paid. Likewise, with even with something like audit or payroll, they're not immediate things that you think of as being associated with the education system, yet they're critical components of it. So I think that was part of our rationale, just doing something a little bit different that took a systems approach and that went beyond just the need for more money, which there is clear evidence for.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Laurie represents thousands and thousands of members all over the world. So my question to Laurie is what role do you think civil society can play, not only at the national level, but also at the local level, to make an impact on support given to teachers in this context?
Thank you, Yolande. I think that when I think about this, I think that context, again, I'm going to go back to context, is really key. And I think there were a list of questions that came into my mind when I was thinking about this. And these are by no means the only questions. But and the first one is, what do we mean by civil society? Sort of who are we talking about when we talk about civil society? Is it non-governmental organizations? Is it the community? Is it teachers' unions on the national level? Sort of who are we talking about? I think within that context, what does civil society have to offer? How safe is it for communities to participate in supporting teachers? What's the stage of the problem? You know, sort of where are we? Is it conflict? Is it fragility? Is it sort of what stage is the problem at? I think a big question also is who runs the schools? And I think that this is something that we often don't think about when we're thinking about, and because we often say we really want the government to take responsibility because that's who should be in charge of the education system. But as we know in Haiti, about 80% of the schools are private schools. So who's running the schools, and what does that mean in terms of civil society engagement? And what can the government offer? I think so much depends on those questions. In situations where teachers are not paid, ensuring that they're paid is critical. And if the resources can come from the government, that's great. But I think this report really lifts up that the community can play a very significant role, either in having funds funneled through the community to pay teachers. I think in places we've seen that the community has actually come to. When I was in Chad, it was clear that the teachers were in place and being supported by the community in some sense, even before the humanitarian workers got there. They were being supported by giving portions of their food rations or in other ways. So their communities, in terms of civil society communities, will mobilize on their own. It's not like we've necessarily got to get in there and help them mobilize. They can do a lot of this with support and encouragement. I think that other things that we've seen in terms of civil society are communities building schools with houses for teachers or facilities for teachers next to them, communities paying school fees on their own, or communities providing foodstuffs, other things for teachers that will help them survive. I think that equitable, there's a whole issue of equity in here too, around communities and support, and does a government support one community and not another? We can talk about that in questions and answers. INEE right now, I'm putting in a little plug here, has a 12-week online dialogue about supporting teachers in fragile and emergency contexts. Every week there'll be a new person writing a blog or an introduction, and then people can get online and discuss teacher support, not just financial support, but really sort of running the gamut. A couple of the things that they've been talking about in this last week have been that communities will often pay, individual families will often pay a teacher more for post daily teaching sessions for tutoring, and teachers will save up their best energy for those tutoring sessions. So if teachers are not being paid in the classroom, they may not be giving their best in the classroom, and they may be saving it for after school. So ensuring that, helping communities ensure that teachers are paid adequately can help the community itself. So, you know, INEE has a bunch of tools for civil society, the minimum standards. We have guidance notes on teaching and learning and teacher compensation. We also have a new set of a new checklist coming out. It's really for donors, but I'm going to put a plug in for that too, to create conflict-sensitive education programs. So all of these things together are, I think, it can help. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Lori. And I have a gigantic question for Rebecca, but she only has like 30 seconds.
Good, yeah. Good. I'm your favorite. Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. No. Yeah, no.
So we've talked about, you know, financial systems. We've talked about these different foundations for teacher support. Do you see other determinants of teacher support other than financial systems that would help with the motivation of teachers' well-being? And
all right, in 30 seconds or less, yes. So one of the things that I think is really important to remember is, you know, and this is true probably anywhere here in the District of Columbia as well as around the world, but particularly in these contexts, teachers are invariably really quite sort of out there on their own. The system is usually often quite broken down. And so there's a whole range of things that I think is really important to think about in terms of teachers' own well-being. You know, and policies, whether they're government policies or community interventions or donor engagement, that can try to think holistically in terms of what are teachers' well-being. How is teachers' well-being in these contexts will be, I think, more successful. So, for example, you know, teachers themselves are often displaced and victims of the conflict themselves, so they often need their own sort of psychosocial supports, whether that's a group of teachers who can get together on a regular basis to talk not only about their teaching profession but also their lives. Teachers need, like everybody else in these contexts, you know, need help with sustaining their families. There's mm-hmm. some studies out there that show that, you know, of course, you're always in these contexts paying a little bit of school fees, and oftentimes teachers go and teach other people's kids but can't even afford to pay the school fees for their own kids to go to school, as well as housing and food. There's also been a range of studies, not a lot, but a range of studies showing that I'm thinking of a study in Liberia that was conducted by Janet Schreiberg early on in post-conflict Liberia, that teachers on average across the country had three jobs. Mm-hmm. Because they weren't paid, then afterwards they had to go to the fields and do some agriculture, and then they had to do something else to get some money. You know, so we need to really think holistically of how to support them. In addition to, which is a large piece, sort of their respect in the community, that motivates teachers a lot. You'll do teacher surveys that, you know, if they're respected, they're seen as been doing an important job, if community members are supporting them, as well as ensuring any way possible sort of their safety, which particularly I would say women teachers have flagged that as an issue. So maybe a minute, 30 seconds that was, but I'll stop
okay.
there.
Well, you give the human dimension to the problem. So thank you very much. We welcome your questions. Just make sure you give us your name and your organization, and we'll just direct your responses to the distinguished panelists. Okay. Oui, Adéa.
My name is Andrew. I come from My name is Zingai Mutumbuka. I come from Adea. First of all, thanks very much for the research. It's very interesting. But from where I sit, some of the diagnostic and also the solutions as outlined by Susie could be applicable to almost any developing country. Particularly contracting out teachers would save many governments' budgets. Or using the PISA, the mobile telephone, could also help. But I have a more fundamental question than just the question of teachers. And I'll illustrate it by an example. I met a colleague in Japan last week where I was attending a meeting. And he told me a harrowing story. And the story was as follows. He was a high school teacher teaching English in a Francophone country. And he said that the best student he ever taught also turned out to be his nightmare. The reasons are as follows. He saw one day the same student who had achieved the highest mark he had ever awarded to any student with a gang of other youth holding big sticks, running around and shouting, "We are going to kill all the people from the north." This is the slogan. So he stopped his car and he called him and said, "Where do you think you are going?" He said, "Well, say we are going to kill all of the people from the north." I asked myself, what is the source of conflict? Because we need to ask ourselves this question. Because if we don't answer that question, it means that we'll always go into conflict. And a good example for me is what happened in Cote d'Ivoire and in Kenya. These were some of the most stable countries in Africa. And they were the last countries we thought in Africa could go into conflict. But we know they went into conflict. My guess is that what the Yolanda from USA said probably needs to be explored better. What are the values that education systems are imparting to our youth? So before you even talk about what are the teachers' conditions, what do education systems do? What I seem to see has happened in Africa is that there has been too much concentration on knowledge and skills and very little on value. I think that education systems need really to ask themselves questions. Can they be also an instrument for addressing the question of conflict and peace? And if our teachers could address this, perhaps we would go some way in resolving constantly the danger of going back into peace, into conflict, sorry.
Thank you. It's an inspiring question. I could tease out two of the questions. The source of conflict, I'm not sure we have time to tackle it now. But isn't it a developing country problem? That was your first question. And then the last one, teaching values. Do any of you want to take that question?
You should answer the values one. You've thought a lot about this. I think, Zengai, you're totally right that this could easily also apply to a number of just very poor countries that or have weak systems and weak structures that aren't necessarily fragile at the moment. But one of the things that I do think we need to, in the future, even though we're not doing it a lot now, is sort of think about, it's something you brought up at the end, that even if you're a stable country at the moment, if you have weak systems, there could be deep inequities in your country, you might be a fragile state in 3 or 4 or 10 years. So it's useful for everybody to think about, I would agree.
Yes. And for the question of values, as you know, we have tried and failed many times to include what we call civic education or character education, whatever we call it, when we try to include it in the curriculum as separate, as a subject matter. It just hasn't worked. We all know that. But when it's integrated into the teaching of skills, then we have a better chance of imparting values. So I think it's the challenge. I mean, we're in a period where we spend a lot of time talking about standardized testing, mm-hmm. and usually that just discards the issue of values. So how can we tackle the issue of standardized testing and learning outcomes so that we can integrate these values? I bet you have an answer to that question yourself in your from your questions. Thank you. Maybe from the other, yeah, Frank, and then we'll go.
My name is Frank Dow. I'm an independent consultant, and I'm happy to still be independent. There are three things that I'd like to point out that I think may be missing, and I think the presentation is excellent. The framework, by the way, is terrifically useful because it's the sort of framework we've all been looking for if we do this sort of work on the ground. There are three things I think you ought to stress, and that is, I've just gone into Somalia with a large UN team to do an analysis of the educational system, water, sanitation, and health. And the missing element was a legal framework to do anything that we wanted to do by way of change or reform. If you don't look at legal frameworks after a collapse of government and begin to revise and review those carefully, anything that you want to do in practice probably doesn't work if people become legalistic. And people forming governments for the first time after a disaster are terribly legalistic. They don't move very fast. They argue about all of these things. That's an important missing element. If we're talking about what's missing with teachers in remote areas, particularly after conflict, aside from food and shelter and all these other things, and it's missing in schools too, it's water and sanitation. I've just gone into schools that used to have water and reasonably good sanitation in several remote areas of Djibouti and Somalia to find that there isn't water and sanitation now because nobody's ever bothered to invest very much in keeping that up. But I mean, you can't live, even if you have a house and you have a little bit of food, without any water at all. And in these semi-desert areas, which are often post-conflict areas, you need to have water, so water is important. The other thing, and you raised it, and I'm amazed that this hasn't come out in the analysis, and I found this everywhere in Namibia, Djibouti, Somalia, Pakistan, Afghanistan. As soon as you get independent groups coming in to run parallel educational systems to help things start up again, you create a distortion in salary allocations. And these distortions continue beyond the small projects that generate this sort of distortion. That is, you set up schools in many parts of Puntland and Somaliland. The only schools that are running are run by NGOs. The salaries the NGOs are paying teachers could never be met by any of the two territory governments that I'm looking at because they don't have the money to even meet a fraction of that in terms of salaries. So how can we talk about salaries in any post-conflict situation just by merely talking about mechanisms when we don't talk about some of these other issues? But it's an important issue you raised. But the framework that you have and the framework that you've given us is a very useful framework. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Susie, do you want to tackle the issue of salary?
Yeah, and I think those are all very good points. I think the salary distortion issue is something that is very much touched upon in the INE guidance notes on teacher compensation. And we felt that because that already existed, we wanted to build on that and sort of build out into a different direction. And, of course, by doing that, we failed to address a number of issues because there's only a finite number of things you can deal with. But very valid point about creating parallel systems and the incentives that creates when you've got NGO level or private sector salaries versus what the state can afford to pay. Okay. It is a big issue.
Yes, thank you. And we've all witnessed that. And then, lady. Yeah, and then.
Thank you. I'm Leon Weintraub, University of Wisconsin. In looking at the figure that you had on the screen earlier, and then following the discussion talking about a systems analysis type of work you did, it seems that a lot of what we've seen could also be applied to other people in the public system, such as a police force with officers around the country or agricultural extension agents around the country. Is there something that's unique about what you've been studying that seems to apply typically to an education system as opposed to other people in public service, such as members of the police force or agricultural extension?
Susie?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think that it would have applicability in a number of different sectors because we took the broad sort of public financial management and salary systems for sort of civil servants that could be applied to other parts. I think what's more unique about the education system is only the size of it. In most countries, the teaching workforce is by far the largest proportion of the civil service. But in terms of functionality as a systems approach, I imagine the building blocks and the cogs would be very similar. You just replace education with agriculture or with security. I'm sure there are probably some more nuanced bits in that because I have no expertise in either of the other sectors. But I think there's definitely applicability in other sectors of the civil service.
Thank you. Yes, maybe there.
Hi, I'm Kim Foles. I'm a lecturer at Teachers College, Columbia University. I was particularly interested in the possibility of mobile payments. I was wondering if you could speak a little more directly on that, because there's a few. I'm just wondering about the logistics of it. For instance, it would have to be if a teacher was picking up their salary and they chose to take the cash rather than credit. It would have to be a particularly cash-rich business, and in areas that might be an issue. How corruptible is it? What is the process of claiming funds? I had another question. Oh, and then the safety of those who do claim the money mm-hmm. once they leave that business, because then it's quite easy to know who's carrying their weekly, monthly, salary with them. Thank you.
Yeah. I think those are issues that we've very much touched upon in the report, the issue of security. And the issue of sort of cash flow, particularly in remote areas which are cut off, how can we ensure that they've got the cash and the goods to be able to pay with? I think because this is very much at pilot stage, those are very much questions that would have to be addressed through any scaling up plan. Rebecca, do you have anything you want to add to that?
One thing I would want to do is actually Yolande. When we were writing this report, Yolande, sent us an email from Afghanistan saying the women teachers are not going to use this mobile in the rural areas are not going to use this mobile payment method. So I think actually you bring up a really good point about safety and security, and I think it really depends on the context and the country, because in many countries, mobile banking is actually much more widespread than it is in developed country contexts. Certainly, Kenya and I think Mongolia actually is like on the cutting edge of mobile banking. Somalia, any place where there's actually few sort of formal banking infrastructure is, way out ahead. And people do it routinely and it's not a problem. But there is an issue around safety and security. And Yolande, did you want to see? It was one particular area that you were worried about.
And that was 2 years ago. I learned that in some areas of Afghanistan, the cell phones look like the remote control detonators for IEDs.
Oh, that's it.
So the last thing you want to see is any civilian with a cell phone, let alone a computer, an iPad, right? I mean, laptop and iPad, and they'll kill you. I mean, so it was a no-no. This time, Solange's tweet 2 weeks ago when I was in Kabul, for mobile banking, we looked at banks were still talking about the best way of doing this. It's complicated, but it goes back to what Susie was presenting. You need banks that really need to be accountable. And, in Afghanistan, it's really hard to find, a bank that has transparent systems. Right now, there are very few. And then you need a phone network that is. So 2 years ago, when the idea of mobile banking came up, there was only one telecommunication network in Afghanistan, the Roshan network. And for every transaction, they charged $4. So, teacher salaries in some places was 15, so no one was going to buy into it. So we had to wait till, there'd be more competition in the telecommunication system. So now there are three or four networks that are ready to tackle in the mobile banking. The issue of remote control, for IEDs has been solved in some parts of Afghanistan, but not in others. So we still have these issues. So it becomes very complex, as you can imagine.
And I think just to add, the issue around security and cash, some of you will know that about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the central market in Bujumbura in Burundi was flattened to the ground by fire. Some of those market traders had $25,000 in cash stored in their market stalls. They had this concept that it was safe there. I mean, it clearly was safe apart from fires, but I mean, it was safe from thieves and so on. If people are putting that level of trust in that sort of thing, then people find ways of getting around not having money in a bank. They put immense trust in a market stall or in stuffing it under their mattress or somewhere else. So I think the security issue is an issue in whatever way you've got cash payments, whatever system you've got where the banking system's weak. So it doesn't really answer the question of how do we solve it, but it's just underlying that it's an issue in lots of other ways outside just mobile banking.
Okay. There was a question back there. Yeah, she's been raising her hand for a while.
Hi, my name is Sarah Ellison, and I'm a master's student in international development at American University and interning over at Wellspring Advisors. I just had a question about how do you think that different levels of fragility in a state, in different regions of a state, affect teachers' salaries and payments, and would a multiple strategy approach work in different countries or in a country with different regions? And how do changes in fragility in a state kind of affect the payments and strategies of payments?
Oh, I'm not taking that question.
I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at but I think what you're talking about is the contextual nuance. Mm-hmm. I think the sort of big framework that we came up with applies anywhere, because those are really the main buckets that you need, as was pointed out before, to kind of process, you know, and support at scale any civil servant sort of cadre. But I think the things that would be different are the solutions. So, you know, if, you know, mobile phones are going to be seen as detonators for bombs and you'll be killed carrying one, then maybe mobile banking is not for you, right? Maybe there's other solutions. So I really think that's what probably the nuance you're seeking. And you would have to figure out what country you're talking about and what the contexts are. I really don't think that there's an easy solution where you say, you know, early post-conflict, late post-conflict, in crisis, after crisis, and you can just randomly pick what those solutions are. You might be able to theoretically, but really you just have to be on the ground and figure out what works.
Yeah, something. Can I add something?
Yes, Lauren.
I think that there are times when the absence of teachers' salaries are a precipitator of or one element in thinking about a state or a region of a country being stable or being fragile. You know, it's one of those things, again, this is, I think, that goes back to the political will question in some ways, where if a government is not paying teachers in a region, why are they not paying? And does that exacerbate state fragility? So I'm just sort of taking your question and turning it a little bit.
Also, I can't resist. There are two sides to it. We need to help these countries reestablish a strong foundation for the education systems, and that will require a long-term strategy. There's no doubt about that, and the support to teacher salaries is part of that, because it's not going to take 2 years to put in place. It's going to take a long time. On the other hand, there is no reason why we should set things in stone, especially on the donor side. We can have transitional strategies. We don't have to come up with a strategy that'll be 10 years of education sector, you know, strategic focus. We can come up with a shorter interim, you know, transitional strategy that will allow us to meet goals that may be not as highly pitched as others, but are reasonable, that are realistic to reach, and then move on. So,
and the Global Partnership for Education is doing some of this now, where they are providing interim sector plans and interim funding. So it's not the long, long term, but it's sort of taking a step in that direction, particularly within fragile contexts.
Yes, thank you. Okay, one more, and then this lady, and then, yes.
Thank you. I'm Jill Christian. Jill Christensen from the National Education Association. A couple things. Certainly, one of the pieces that I hope really is distilled within the paper, and I really look forward to reading it, is, in fact, stakeholders themselves, teachers themselves, asking them what the issues are and the solutions. A couple years ago, I was in Liberia on our project there, talking to teachers, and one teacher travels 4 days a month to collect his pay, mm-hmm. 2 days each way, which means he abandons his classroom, has petrol costs and other things in order to get there and get back, as well as in, again, if he were a woman, greater risk in that process. So really asking those questions. And one question, though, that I do have as far as the paper, and that is, did you address when there are gaps in pay? For example, very often when economies are really struggling, governments are struggling, it could be many months between when teachers are paid and how they manage in that way.
I mean, I think the quick answer, Jill, and it's a good point, is yes. So given that we have like 3 more minutes, that's probably all I'll say. But we did look at all of those contexts, where pay was happening, but it could be 3 months, could be 4 months, could be 6 months before teachers get it, and when there was no system for doing it all. And there's a bunch of other sort of contexts we looked at.
Should we take one more question or go to concluding remarks?
I think we need to wrap up.
We'll wrap up.
Unfortunately, I see many hands.
Many.
I know. Come talk to us after.
Right, please do. Please do. And I'm glad the presentation is prompting so many reactions. So we'll just proceed with quick final remarks. Wait, do you want to say something?
I do. In terms of ADEA and conflict, the ICQN, the Inter-Country Equality Note on Peace, I think is doing a really good job. I'll boast about it for you. In working from the government level down to the grassroots in terms of promoting conflict-sensitive education. And just my closing remark would be thank you so much for creating the report. We'll be promoting it heavily throughout the INEE network. And I think that it really does fill a gap that's been out there and sort of lift up a new way of thinking about teacher compensation, which is a critical, critical issue.
Thank you. Thing to say, Rebecca, would you like to?
No, just very much to say thanks to everybody, and that I think, again, I want to come back to Zengai's, the very first question, that, you know, the report and what we did is very much a nuts and bolts how-to, but it's a really big, important issue that is overlooked, and you can't succeed without addressing it. But Zengai brought up the big, big picture, which is, you know, clearly we need to get education systems to continue providing services in these contexts, in these difficult contexts, as well as to rebuild the systems, particularly in early recovery contexts. But the ultimate question is, what are we educating people for? Mm-hmm. Like, what types of citizenry are we creating? And, you know, a teacher is having a very, very important role to play in that. So maybe we'll have you back for our next session on that topic.
Steve, do you want to have a final word?
Yeah, I think just to sort of build on what Rebecca said, I think our report very much took the systems approach, looked at one specific aspect, and there were probably a number of you that could have said a whole other things that we've missed out of the report, which we're completely honest about. We focused on one area. We therefore had to discard a lot of other really important areas, issues around learning, around what education is for, issues around curriculum and the approach to make sure that the very values question that was raised right at the beginning is integral to what education is about. We couldn't seek to address those questions in such a report, so inevitably we had to sort of shelve a load of other really important issues to focus on what we did. So we do that partly unapologetically because that was our focus, but I just wanted to really recognise that we did have to leave out a whole lot of issues.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. I challenge you all to be your practitioners, your implementers. Do more research on the topic. Make it even stronger with evidence and good practices. Thank you very much for coming, and have a good rest of the afternoon.